I'm Anthony Wright, and this is Attunement, a guide to mystical experience. On today's Attunement, we talk with Tanto, or practice leader, Fu Schrader, at the San Francisco Zen Center's Green Gulch Farm in Marin County. I had questions about Buddhism and Zen Buddhist practice. Fu began by telling a story about a Zen master who was speaking to a layperson from just off the street, explaining what Buddhism was. And the master said, unconditioned consciousness is the Buddha way.
It's magnificent and it's natural. And right. Let me show you. And he calls to the young monk who's sweeping and he says, hey, you. And the young monk turns his head and he says, this is the magnificent awareness of all the Buddhas. And then he says to the young monk, so what is it? And the young monk blushes and runs away. He can't respond, even though he is the magnificent awareness of all the Buddhas. He can't yet respond to a basic question like, well, what is it? Or who are you? He thinks there's an answer.
Well, that is the
question. He thinks there's a response that he should know. So he feels right away that he's, I don't know. I don't know. Oh, you asking me?
Right,
I'm just sweeping
right.
up around here, you know?
Yeah.
So that's everyone's dilemma, is how to understand the teaching is pointing to the fact that you're Buddha. You have this inheritance and you don't get it. You don't get what that means. And that's our natural human condition, is we don't get that. That's what a human is. They don't get what it means that they're a Buddha, that they're awake. So you spend,
is that waking up then?
When you get it.
Oh, it's to wake up. Right,
you're
right,
like,
right, right.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
You see? Oh, and then there's a kind of, maybe the young boy would have smiled.
But you're awake already.
But he doesn't think he can answer the question. He goes, what? When the master says, hey, you, the boy has no problem. He's right there. Yes. What is it? I don't know. That's right. You don't know.
And that's an authentic response.
It would be, but he didn't feel so. He felt that he didn't know. He was saying, I don't know, like, I don't know and I could know.
Oh.
Or I should know. Or there's a way to know. Which is the normal way of knowing things.
Which are relaxed.
Once you learn it, here's the answer. It's number three. Choice number three.
Right.
You know, there's a fine line between not knowing that not knowing is the right answer and not knowing and playing and not. So there's a fine line that is the work of and the craft of the teacher-student relationship. It's like, something a little off here. There's something a little off here. And your own teacher has worked you through those little moments of something's a little off here. And so little by little, you begin to get some feeling for how to dance with the situation that's arising. How to be with it. If you're embarrassed, that's right. If you have an answer, that's fine. So it's really that you're backing yourself up, however you're appearing. You're with yourself. You don't abandon yourself. You know, like, oh, I'm the one who doesn't know. As though you could get away from yourself in that moment of embarrassment.
Well, and really, what I'm studying is that there is no one. There is no Anthony to respond.
Theoretically. And yet, hey you, what's your name? Anthony.
Right. But that just happens to be the name.
It's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, you're free to be Anthony. Is Anthony free? And when you are, maybe there's nothing there that is of concern. And when you're
right.
feeling contracted and reduced
right.
and confused and angry and frustrated and mistrusting and whatever that is, well, that's something called Anthony too. And what's that quality all about? What's that reduced form? Well, that's a wonderful part of who we are as well. Not to
yes.
try to abandon any of these manifestations, but to see how all of them are of the nature of reality as it's appearing right now. It's like, wow.
To accept that completely.
Well, it's like accept what's happening.
Right. Because
yeah.
that's the natural iteration of everything in the moment anyway.
It's just what's happening.
Right.
But
right.
we tend to think we could do something else. We imagine we could do something other than what's happening. We could control, manipulate, alter, reduce, eliminate. So we have all these verbs for things we could do other than what's happening, based on a view of separation.
Okay.
It's based on seeing things as separate. In fact, we do see things as separate. We actually do. We have to admit that. I do see things as outside of myself. Most people, when you talk about that, go, well, what are you talking about? What do you mean outside of myself? Well, it's just a simple confirmation that you really do see things as outside of yourself, but you know that they're not outside of yourself. You understand that they're not outside of yourself, even though the illusion is that they are, and that there is an inside and an outside. That's what I see. And I bet you that's what you see, too.
The illusion of inside and outside.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're working on these two projects simultaneously. One is what you see.
Right.
And the other one is what you know to be so.
And yet, there are points where I happen to blow out, where there is no Anthony, where Anthony understands that there's just nothing that can be done, that, you know, by Anthony to the way that the world iterates.
Yeah.
So that there really was no Anthony to begin with.
Right. And that's a nice little interlude. You know, we long for those. It's like the cream filling, you know, in the box of chocolates. We really want that one. And we have a tendency to wish that one would stay. But my understanding of these things is it's just another illusion. It's an illusion of nobody there. That's another kind of illusion, that whatever you've got there is just another illusion. And that they're all illusions. They're not high-grade, low-grade, you know, preferred, stable, let's stay with this one. You just keep allowing that, as Wei Nung, the sixth ancestor's poem, was, you know, pointing to the wisdom of, you know, he was responding to the senior monk in the Platform Sutra, the very beginning of the Platform Sutra. Hui Nong, who's this illiterate woodcutter, comes to the monastery. He's sent to pound rice by the fifth ancestor, who has a feeling that this is a worthy, but he knows better than to stick him at the front of the line, because there's a lot of human jealousy would,
right,
you know.
Political stuff.
Political stuff. So he sends him to pound rice, and he says to Hui Nong, is the rice white yet? Is it white? And Hui Nong says, it's white, but it hasn't been sifted. So the teacher then hits the mortar three times. And Hui Nong responds by shaking the sieve three times. And then he enters the abbot's room, and they have doksan. So the abbot knows this is a worthy one, but he also knows he isn't trained. He hasn't been sifted. So,
and Hui Nong himself knows.
He knows he needs this help, this support that comes from having others who've gone before, basically help guide you through these various potential traps, and. You know, so then the head monk writes a poem, these two famous poems on the wall, expressing his understanding. You know, the body is a mirror stand, the mind is the mirror, and keep wiping carefully so no dust alights in the mirror.
Right, so I remember this.
Very good karmic advice. You keep just cleaning the mind, cleaning yourself, following the precepts, being kind, generating compassion, very good things will happen for you and those around you. This is the realm of karma, of generating good karma. Mm-hmm. It'll keep you out of hell. However, it's still karmic. It's dualistic. You're imagining that there's something impure and that you're working like this to keep that impurity away from clouding your mind. But Hui Nong's insight was, the body, there is no body stand. The body's not a stand. The mirror has no substance.
Right,
and where
right.
would the dust land? There's no place for these dusts to alight.
Mm-hmm.
So this gesture is futile. You know, this wiping.
Even though it's a good practice karmically and it
karmically
gains merit. And
it'll get you out of hell, but it won't enlighten you. It will keep you limited to a dualistic view of how the world actually works. Whereas Hui Nong had the true insight that there was no substantial, the illusion was the illusion, there was no substantial being there that needs to be doing this thing that creates a pure outcome. You know, so he'd already busted through what's called the double enclosure, the self and other enclosure. He'd broken through it.
Because that's what I felt when Anthony disappeared. And that's just, you know, and since that time, I've been hanging out in understanding, well, what is showing up.
You can call it whatever you like.
Right, exactly.
There's a lamp and I think they call this a folder. And,
right.
You know, it's a lot of electrical equipment.
But I mean, with who this human is.
Well, it's conventionally no problem to say, this Anthony, I work for a radio station and I have 10 fingers and 10 toes.
Right.
Maybe,
right.
I assume.
Right, yes.
So it's fine for you to identify with conventional language. But if you actually identify with conventional language, which is what most people do, is this is my body, I'm over here, this is my property, this belongs to me, you're interfering with my life.
It's a weird thing.
That's self-clinging is what's destructive.
Right.
And that behavior is evidence of a self-view that's not just being utilized as a kind of conventional tool to get your credit card, you know, activated, but it's being used as actual structure in which you're trapped. You've trapped, you know, so perhaps...
And you're trapped in it because you believe it's real.
You think it's true.
Right. Exactly.
And you'll go to the death, you know, like defending your honor or whatever that is. And it's kind of silly. Like, you're defending your what? Against what? You know?
And I've been reading, the Nagarjuna 70 stanzas and the middle path, which is another, or the 20...
Garfield?
Yes, Garfield. Uh-huh. Where Nagarjuna is talking about deconstructing
everything.
Know, the chariot, you know, well, is there a chariot? And then you take the wheels off, is it still a chariot? Well, you take the box apart, is it still a chariot? You take the wheel apart, is it still a wheel? All the way down to the quantum level.
Yeah, and beyond.
And beyond, right.
Which is what happens to physicists. They run out.
Right. And they're going, well, and Robert Thurman was talking about, even with the prehensile grasp of modern mathematics, they can find which way, the faster they chase it, the faster it runs in front of them. And he's talking about, because I've really been drawn to the study of emptiness, of voidness, and really coming to understand, to resonate, I guess is perhaps the best way that I can speak about it, about the infinite relativity of the infinite relativity, that there is no, that even voidness is void.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's that, essential, because the tendency to equate voidness with empty, and empty with empty, and void, and nothing, and nihilism.
They're trapping words.
It's a very tempting and seductive, you know, mistake in this consideration. That people equate, when they hear emptiness, they think of a glass that has no water in it.
That's nihilistic, right?
And that's
There's
nihilistic.
No, nothing in there. But Alan Watts also spoke about it as no thingness, which has also been useful to say, okay, I can look at this bench here, and I can call it a bench. But even in the Diamond Sutra, Buddha was talking to Saputi, well, but that's only the word for that. And it's really much more than what that is.
But that you actually do not reify this as an object. You do not impute any essential nature to an object.
Right.
Is even though we can intellectually understand and deconstruct, We may be imputing some kind of subtle essence to intellectual processes. You know, the tendency to impute essences, to reify objects or objects of thought, material objects, is so inbred or inborn in us.
Instinctive.
That to really drop that, I think one of the challenges is that it is very, very, in my brief, momentary willingnesses to suspend this, that there is an object, there's anything other than an object. So for me, one of the stunning moments of my career, you know, in trying to understand this material, was to consider the teaching that there's only the object. There's no subject. So I was saying kind of the same thing as saying there's no self. There's no self, but not only is there no self, there's only this object.
Right.
There's only this object. And what happened in my experience, in looking back on it, because at the time it was perhaps somewhat like what you were saying, the subject vanished. Object only means, and indeed points to, there's no subject. And if there's no subject, there is, for me, there was a very powerful moment of terror.
Well, one confronting what one thought was nihilism.
No, confronting what one thinks is me and having me gone.
Oh, right.
So
right.
It's one thing to say there's no self. I'm pretty cozy with that. I can say that in the dining room. I can say that while I'm eating. I can say that while I'm walking around. I can say that, but to experience no self and to really, I'm more comfortable experiencing emptiness of objects. Oh, aren't I clever? I figured out that objects are empty. But to actually experience the emptiness of oneself is, my understanding and my experience of that is that this is terrifying and that the only approach one can take repeatedly if you're going to explore down that corridor is to get used to terror. Because the body, this tendency to equate selflessness with annihilation is so inborn in us as living entities that our entire survival depends on us believing that we're here.
Oh, right. It goes way limbic, yeah. To be selfless is not to be annihilated, though. Right?
I wouldn't testify to that. I would not testify to that. Objects only.
If Anthony goes away and the Anthony-ness is this goes into this infinite relativity of infinite relativity. Let me state it a different way. As a piano technician, I understand in a real way that Anthony is a standing wave. If you know, do you know what I mean by a standing wave?
Yeah.
Okay. So that, you know, the bench and the human and even the thought forms that the human has are standing waves and they're events that are only events because they're relating to something else.
Well, according to Nagarjuna, there is no movement from one to the other. That's a mental construct. Well, there's no motion. There's no going from A to B because that would imply two moments in time.
There are no two moments in time.
There's only present moments. So you don't have movement. You have an illusion of movement. A wave is a result of an illusion, which is conceptual, of this, the same thing that the ear, you know, holds something from what we imagine then was before. There's various studies that have been done about how the mind simply substitutes, it makes up, it creates a draft in the present moment that accounts for the fact that these various different things have happened to it, and then it comes up with the latest theory, the current draft of what's happening. But that draft is the only thing you got there, and there is no wave, there's no movement, there's no, it's just kind of like your latest printer printout. How about this? Oh, no. How about this? How about this?
Because we get new information, what we think is new information.
Yeah. But, you know, it moves so fast, and we go through, you know, I don't know how many thousands of these in a second, or you know, it's what the neurobiologists are looking at. It's called multiple draft theory of consciousness, that there's no observer ego. There's no Cartesian model. There's nobody sitting there in the movie theater watching the show.
Oh,
there's
just wonderful.
Just the draft. And it's like, no, there's no self, and there is this kind of object only. Like, here's a presentation, here's another one.
So then, how does Anthony best serve to awaken and to awaken all beings then, that way, this moment, you know?
I think you just assume that it's already happened, and you go forward in being as kind and socially, gracious as you can possibly be, because that's, you know, what seems to be called for on this planet. And the more of that there is, the better off we'll all be. You know, Buddha said this whole thing, this whole enterprise is not at the service of wisdom. It's at the service of compassion. So we're not trying to become the smartest, most clever, most intellectually satisfied beings. We're striving to use that intellectual satisfaction and spiritual satisfaction to benefit others.
Right.
That's the point of the enterprise.
Well, because the other is myself. Or the other is the self of which this facet happens to be a member.
That's
right.
It's
like one of my fingers attempting to help another, or one of my hands helping another hand.
That's right. And when you forget that that's true, you'd be nice anyway.
right.
Because we do forget. We forget that these are my fingers. These are my toes wiggling in my own shoes. Right. You know, we forget. We're very subject to mind wipes. We don't hold that vision against all of the bombardments that tell us that you're in danger. You're here. You're in danger. You better self-protect. And I love the story of the samurai who comes into the master who's seated, and he wants him to teach him, and the master's told him to go away. Right. And the samurai pulls his sword out and says, "Don't you know I'm the one who can kill you?" And the master says, "Don't you know I'm the one who can be killed?" And then the samurai sheathes his sword.
So that's going to take a minute. More than a minute. Thank you. Oh, that's good.
Are we really willing to be betrothed to the self as other, or other as self? Are we really willing to make that? Like, I was listening to Prince's song on the radio, and it said, "I'm not your friend, I'm not your lover, I'm the one who would die for you." You know, and it's like... Oh, that's, yeah, you can't understand who I am. I'm the one who will die for you. Is that, am I willing to not defend? Am I willing to be peaceful or harmless, regardless of the threats to myself? Mm-hmm. Is that, mm-hmm. you know, where's the real test of that commitment? So self-clinging is when we kind of resort to, well, that's all nice theory, but actually... I'm going to protect this one. I'm going to.
Well, my kids are gone.
It's very challenging.
My kids are gone, and so there is really no one for Anthony to protect Anthony for.
Well, there's still Anthony.
Right, but.
He might have a few needs of his own.
Right, and yet, in attending to what the vow of the Bodhisattva is, mm-hmm. to end the suffering of all sentient beings, right?
Not quite. The job of the Bodhisattva, the stated job, is I vow to awaken with
right.
all beings.
Oh, okay.
To save them means I vow to bring whatever I can to bear on helping them to awaken.
So
save them. They have to save themselves. I'm really sorry
for you
people.
For that.
But,
that's
you know,
right.
You're really on your own here.
Right.
You know? And awakening will help you out a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll be able to really figure things out a lot better if you wake up.
Because then everything comes into a much different kind of
modality. You're a different species.
Yeah.
You're a different species. You've shifted from sentient being to Buddha. And that shift, which is where Buddhas come from, is from sentient beings. There's no other location for a Buddha than from a sentient being. They're
right.
partners. It's a team sport. You don't get one without the other.
Right.
Then that process of awakening beings is... You know, is the great Mahayana vow is to bring all beings to awakening, thereby that this will be the possibility of true peace,
right?
And contentment and, you know, kindness and so on can be realized.
So that's what Anthony wants to do.
And that's what Anthony wants to do, and that's a wonderful thing to want to do.
Right. One gets attending to not getting caught by the desire to do that.
That's right. That's called the golden chain.
So I've been studying and taking a look at the Lotus Sutra and going, okay, you know, the parable of the rich man trying to get his kids out of the house that's mm-hmm. going to collapse, you know, that's mm-hmm. really wonderful. I'm going to think, how am I going to do that? Well, and this radio program is one of the ways to do that. It just seems to be a natural evolution, and it's easier actually to refer as Anthony rather than the I, because that seems to be less of a trap somehow. But I want to be wary of that, too.
Well, you know, you can redecorate, you know, but ultimately, you know, I think it's best to assume that we haven't finished our work and that we're falling into the ego traps continuously and calling that. Say, like, I don't really know, folks. You can project whatever you like on this entity over here and... whatever virtues you may think are pouring off of it or whatever you want or crimes or, you know, whatever you're doing over here is okay. And I'm just going to keep acknowledging that I experience myself as a limited, confused and bottlenecked entity. And at the same time, I want you to know that I'm really devoted to this teaching that came into my life. And yeah, I would share it with you if you'll give me 5 minutes of your time. Or whatever you got, you know. But it's an offering that you're making from your best shot. You're just, I always feel like the more I think of myself and my friends here as just amateurs, and we're really devoted to playing the game as best we can and, you know, learning the rules and caring for the books and all that sort of thing. And that's, you know, there's something quite sweet about the village songs and festal drinking. We're these commoners who are just working very hard to care for this tradition.
And that's one of the jewels, is the Sangha.
It's the Sangha jewel. And if we don't get too inflated and we don't get too deflated and we stay in good intimate contact with one another, then, you know, I was saying to one man today that when we grow the tail of our karmic past, all of us have these long tails from all the things we've done and mistakes we've made and thoughts we've thought. And when we begin to realize that that's what's causing us, that's what's dragging us, and we begin to, you know, mourn those losses and really acknowledge those mistakes, then there's a lot of mourning and grieving that goes on. But that process, at some point, that tail turns into a little bit more of a stub. You don't have this kind of long, draggy tail. And then you need to keep current with yourself so that you don't start growing another one, that you're actually moving forward from a commitment to your integrity, your honesty, your willingness to be, you know, corrected or whatever it is that people like to do to us. And that one of the ways they help us is that they'll step on that tail if it starts growing again. You know, people will get irritated because they're stepping on our tail, and then we can see that we're accumulating some karmic debt again. And we can stay up with ourselves and continue, you know, devoting ourselves to understanding, you know, as like a very ongoing day-to-day commitment. Day after day after day, we all want to help keep this freshness in our practice. So Sangha is very helpful in that way, because it's hard for a person alone to receive enough reflections of themselves. It's very easy to fool ourselves if we don't have somebody saying, well, excuse me, but you missed a spot back here.
Right. But that it is possible, because Buddha did it, actually through a great amount of effort of, 6 years of studying and mastering these various disciplines and saying, well, no, that's not it, and that's not it, and that's not it. But even through the night before he became enlightened, he was challenged by those four realms before finally he came to the, was it the understanding of emptiness?
Or non-duality, non-separation.
Okay. And that's what it was.
I am not, there's not, that star is not other than myself.
Right.
And all things are awakened at the same time with me. My awakening is of the awakening of the universe. I am none other than the universe waking up. And all beings are the universe.
Yeah.
They just don't know who they are. They've mistaken themselves for some tiny...
And that's the ignorance.
That's the ignorance, the clouds of delusion.
It.
Exactly. They're mistaking their minds and their thoughts and their ideas and their what they've been told about who they are. They're mistaking that for who they are. And they're overlooking their magnificence as living beings.
Well, and that's some of the wonderful things that I'm discovering with Nagarjuna in debunking all of the sense objects and the mind objects, and to really get down to this infinite relatedness and the infinite relatedness of the infinite relatedness.
Yeah.
To go, that it is really all one being, one field.
And it shows up as individual conventional objects. That is, this is the universe in the form of what
that
is called a lamp. It's not like you get down to where there's no thing. Again, if you, Garfield says in, I think, one of his last lines in the Majjhimaka chapter, that you know, Nagarjuna basically did away with a notion of something deep. And basically what he was doing was bringing us back to the surface without the deep. There's nothing below. There's nothing deep within, you know, like, oh, when I really get deep inside myself or something. It's like, what are you talking about? It's right here. It's constantly being revealed. There's not some hidden reality behind called emptiness.
Right.
Oh, and when I see things from this other point of view, like there's an idea that you know, you're going to get a look behind the mask. There isn't nothing behind the mask. There's just the mask. And the mask, mm-hmm. it takes the form of these objects that we give conventional language to, but that's the only way we know anything is through conventional.
But it's
Nagarjuna equated emptiness with conventional designations. This is the middle way. He said, the dependent co-arising, the magnificence of creation, is empty of inherent existence, and this is itself, what I just said, is a conventional designation. I just used language to say that thing I just said.
Uh-huh.
That's all I got.
Uh-huh.
That itself, speaking in conventional language in regards to dependent co-arising, concerning the emptiness of all creation, is itself the middle way. So what Nagarjuna did that was magnificent was to reinsert the conventional into the mystical. The mystical was going in the direction of unity. You know,
right.
The mystical theories had to do with unification with Brahma or unity with God or whatever these fanciful notions that people really cherish about liberation, that I'm going to be in the golden light. I mean, when you hear that kind of talk, that you're going to transcend the mundane world and live in some kind, you know, there's the asteroid comes and everybody wants to get on the asteroid and,
right.
and, you know, escape planet Earth. And it's like, so there is a fantasy in the human psyche of getting out of here. And what Nagarjuna did was he made us come right back here. He said, this is the golden light.
I've been,
right here.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is the golden light, believe it or not. This, you know,
microphone.
Object, yeah, microphone, and this, in these clothes, and,
right.
and these hairy legs, and, you know, this is the golden light.
And I've been driving around West Marin, noticing the extraordinary beauty and the real jewel-like quality of everything, of Anthony in it, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing, and that it isn't anywhere else, and that it is all right here. That's really one of the hopes of in the radio show, is to invite people to come to that point of awareness. And it's certainly each person has to do that for themselves, but it's...
Well, sometimes it's done to you. You know, there are you know, those encounters with airbags and that actually, you know, wake people up. They have a moment of like, oh my God, where have I been? You know, I remember a car accident when I was
right.
in college, and it just was like the next day, I don't think I'd ever looked at one of the trees at San Francisco State College before, ever. And
mm-hmm.
all I saw were trees.
Yeah.
And needles on trees have needles? You know, it was like, oh, where have I been?
Jewels, yeah.
Where have I been? I've been going to college here for 4 years. I've never looked at a tree before.
Just enwrapped in that psychological or cognitive momentum.
We're trapped in this discursive, this constant running back and forth in the mind of the language trap. And
mm-hmm.
for people to stop that language trap,
mm-hmm.
to really stop it, this is the first step in meditation training, is to help people learn how to stop the discursive thinking, to calm it down,
right.
quiet it down, stop paying attention to it, you know, take away the car keys. It's like you are not in charge anymore, and you're grounded.
Well, I really came to a point of the ego is a wonderful servant, but a horrible master.
Yeah.
I mean, it does some wonderful things. It helps us, and we were talking about this on the phone. I mean, it helps us make the money to eat and to get various things in our life, but for it to think that that to me in Western culture is the big trap to for everyone to assume that that's it.
Yeah, right.
That we're caught in that. And there was an article by George Miller in the Psychological Review where he said the cognitive awareness only has 7 ± 2 bits of attention that it can, and that's, and anything else falls out. And we're caught in this limbic 7 ± 2.
Right.
And then there's a lot of stuff that's leveraged from that
right.
that we choose to accept in this culture at present.
That's right. Well, we're adepts. We're adepts at discursive thinking, at cognitive manipulation. We've got this forebrain, this latecomer to the, you know, evolutionary theory, so-called theory, you know, and it's taken over. It's the new kid on the block, and it's taken over from what is our sensory, our much older, our breath, very old. Breath is very old. You know, lizards breathe, chickens breathe. You know, there's a very old relationship with breathing that we re-enter in the meditation room. We're going back into the egg. We're going back to that place where that first breath is gained and appreciated, and then it's repeated. You stay there. Just stay with those first breaths like a newborn. Don't go away from there. Just develop your concentration. And as you deepen your concentration, the tranquility deepens and broadens and widens. And that's the highest form of bliss, is this tranquility. And people, when they're tranquil, when they're at peace, that's the carrot at the end of the stick that keeps them going. It's like, I want more of that. Good. Okay, you want more of that? Good. That's right. Okay, you keep coming back for more tranquility. And when you're really tranquil, then you'll be ready for insight. Because insight requires you to come back into the discursive realm. To read the Lotus Sutra, you've got to use your discursive mind. And all of a sudden you get like, well, this is good. Oh, that's amazing. Well, did you notice what they're doing here? And pretty soon you're going, ding. And you're starting to get excited. So then you say, okay, close the book, calm down, hold still, regain your tranquility. And then, okay, now open the book again. And it's like, you train yourself. You train this untrained being. Okay. To use its mind and to use its breath and its body in concert, so that what you event like you as a musician, until you drop away, you kind of back off there and allow the various lessons and practices that have brought you to the place where you can actually step away or drop away, you're not needed there. You don't have to tell your fingers what to do next.
And that's the bringing of the being, the human, to the peak functionality where transparency occurs.
Transparency occurs, and that's a wonderful thing, and it doesn't last, and that's fine too.
Well, now, did it not last for Buddha? For Shakyamuni?
He quite willingly and knowingly came down off the mountain. He went up the mountain. That's the wisdom side of our training. You go up the mountain, you realize egolessness, you realize emptiness, you realize nirvana, perfect peace. But that's a minor accomplishment, not worth talking about.
It's a preparation.
You have a complete awareness of the functioning of the world and of non-dual reality, which is the complete awareness of a Buddha, which is the knowledge of all modes, is in the Lotus Sutra. Yep, so, you know, you clear out that old gunk, get rid of the attic stuff that you've been carrying around, make room for the new input, which is this wonderful understanding of the Dharma and how it works and how beings understand, and neurobiology and music theory, and you just fill up with all this wonderful understanding of the world and of the teaching. Then you come down off the mountain now that you're all educated, re-educated.
Attuned, yes.
Back to the village to talk to people who don't know what you're talking about. Because your whole point, the whole reason you went through all of that, so that you could come back down. So the downside of the mountain is the compassion side. The Buddha left the seat. He got up at the pleading of the gods. He says, please, you've accomplished this great, marvelous accomplishment. Don't sit here enjoying yourself. There are some people who are have been working really hard, and they could, if you gave them your help, they could understand what you understand. And even though he was reluctant, because he says in the sutra, this will be a vexation to me.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Even the dear Buddha knew it was going to be challenging to deal with these confused, ignorant beings, as indeed it is.
But that's other than being condescending. It's just speaking about the state of what their choices have been or are in the moment, right?
And they're very irritating.
Well,
they wear you out. mommy, what about, okay, one more time. So it is, the Buddha was a teacher. We're a teaching lineage. And that's what people who come here are training to do. You know, they can teach in a variety of forms. It's not all expounding. Some people teach by farming or repairing carburetors, or there's all modes of teaching. But basically, people come here in order to first clarify their own pain and issues and find the release that helps them to walk lightly, and mm-hmm. then to bring how that worked for them to others who come in endless supply, you know? There is no end to the freshman class. You know, there will always be uh-huh. a new group of folks coming in here who are in terrible pain, who are really lost, who are very confused, who don't speak, who have no self-esteem,
right.
who've, you know, had horrific childhoods right. or had magnificent childhoods and are incredibly arrogant. And so
that's just as much of a trap.
So whatever way it's gone, then we patiently and willingly and kindly welcome them and tell them to please have a seat. That's the cooking pot.
Mm-hmm.
And that we'll be willing to cook you here, and we'll keep the lid on. And if you'll just be patient and learn to trust that something's going to change. As Charlotte Silver said to her students when she'd have them lay on the floor for an hour and a half, she said, if you lay on the floor long enough, my dear friends, I promise you something will change, and it's not going to be the floor.
That's wonderful. So, because I've been reading that the part of the compassion in the practice of the Dharma, if, and correct me if my terminology is incorrect, but is the discourse, is the speaking between, you know, from one person to another.
Totally. That's essential.
And working it through. And
well, in the Zen tradition, which saw its formation in China in the 8th century, mm-hmm. 9th century, when it really began to gel as its own approach and its own expression of the Buddhist understanding.
Now, was that by Dogen?
No, way before Dogen.
It was, okay.
Dogen went to China and received this instruction right. from teachers who were in the lineage from Huainong. So the sixth ancestor was the
oh, that's right.
the big guns.
So
he was the sixth from Bodhidharma. So Bodhidharma was an Indian. He came to China
mm-hmm.
and transmitted the Zen understanding, this particular right. way that emphasized sitting and wall gazing. So Bodhidharma sat in a cave and stared at a wall. They called him the Indian who stares at a wall.
Fascinating.
So we stare at walls.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is our lineage here in this mm-hmm. Zen tradition that we're following. He gazed at the wall. It's kind of like Charlotte's laying on the floor.
I
promise you something will change, and it's not going to be the wall. So so we engage in this practice. And then as the centuries went by and the descendants of Bodhidharma gained their understanding and passed it to their disciples, by the time it came to the sixth ancestor, Huainong, who was the man I was mentioning first
right.
from the Platform Sutra, who writes the poem, there is
right.
no body stand, there is no mirror to wipe clean, you know, why would you make these gestures? You know, his poem became the emptiness teachings became embedded and emphasized in the Zen tradition. So you have the embedding of the emptiness of Nagarjuna, but also the Yogacara teachings became instrumental to the Zen tradition. So right in the Platform Sutra, you can see the laying down of all the elements of the Zen tradition that you can spot walking around here today. Face-to-face discussion with a teacher.
Uh-huh.
That happened in the Platform Sutra. There's that meeting with a teacher. Huainong meets with his teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then he escapes at midnight.
Oh, yes, I remember
you know,
this.
He takes the robe and the teaching.
And the bowl.
He runs off because of the jealousy of the monks. So this is rather interesting. And then we do this midnight Dharma transmission ceremony here. That's when you get your transmission from your teacher, is at midnight. So we've basically all of these elements
wonderful.
Are incorporated mm-hmm. in so-called contemporary enactment
mm-hmm.
of the Zen understanding or Zen school's way.
But there's a real presence with that, though, too. I'm just thinking about resonance, but it really puzzles me. I'm continuing to explore, then, about this notion of resonance in the present moment, about this transmission of resonance implies that there's a beginning and an end, right?
Could.
I'm wanting to attend to what you were talking about earlier, though,
yeah.
about what Nagarjuna was talking about. There's just this moment, and there's no prior or no past and no future.
Right. And then you just said all of that.
Yes.
So even though we say all of that, there's right. no past and there's no future, we experience the beginning of our sentences and the ends of our sentences right. and that there's something that we actually think we understood that happened from something that started, continued, and ceased. So we say things like there's just the present moment. It took me a while to say there's just the present moment.
Yes, that's correct. You're right. You're right. And
so mm-hmm. what's going on there, you mm-hmm. know? What are we talking about? Well, the Buddha was willing to transgress through the vehicle of language, which is the primary pointer in the Zen tradition is toward the mind that thinks. It's a thinking mind. It's this thinking that is seen as the culprit. Even though, and as you said, it's also our gift, our egoic gift, mm-hmm. or discursive thinking is a great gift. But it's the nature of our entrapment is this thinking mind. And how mm-hmm. it weaves these apparent connections and makes meaning out of words and, mm-hmm. you know, it strings them along.
And we can communicate some useful things with that. But
very, very handy.
I want to offer to you my experience as a piano tuner to say, okay, what you're speaking about is analogous then to the music that is played on the well-tuned piano. When a mm-hmm. piano, for me, when I'm working on a piano and I'm having it prepared to really a peak of its capability, the piano will seem to disappear and not impede the performance of music upon it.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're speaking about then is that in getting trapped in the cognition, the human, in a way, is like getting trapped in their own music.
Yeah, well, they're taking...
Rather than hanging out, it's just the piano that's tuned well.
They're taking this sign or sound or primary event of a sound or a sight or mm-hmm. a smell.
Yes,
sense objects. And we're basically attributing... So there's some kind of impact, there's some kind of contact that occurs, and then we attribute... There's a subtle series of events that happen in the mind where we attribute significant, we signify.
But it's arbitrary. The assignment of significance is arbitrary.
No, it's conventional, meaning that we agree on the assignments.
Well, and
because
convenient.
Otherwise, you're just trapped in madness.
I couldn't have met you here today at 4:00.
No,
We couldn't have come together.
No, and right. And if we don't deal in conventionals, or if you're totally mad and you're calling that a cucumber, that lamp a cucumber, and
yes.
I'm saying, actually, that's a lamp, and everyone else in this valley agrees with me, I'm sorry, Anthony, but you're
right.
nuts. You
right.
know. So
right.
we do have these conventional designations
right.
that we utilize, and we are trained, we're taught them. Mama taught you those, you know.
And yet it's important to be mindful of that.
It's important to know that there's nothing, there is absolutely no relationship between that word lamp and da-da.
The thing
this
that throws
stunning,
that lovely little...
Little...
And that's
know?
what the Diamond Sutra is about. The Buddha was saying, Subhuti, this is only a name of this. It's not the real thing of what
the
you're speaking about.
It can't be said. The real thing is ineffable.
Right.
The sacred is ineffable, and it's everywhere. It's all ineffable, and yet we keep throwing names. We keep slapping Post-its on the world, and we keep
right.
pointing fingers at the world, and we keep extracting objects from the magnificence of creation itself and saying, that's my lamp, and I'll sell it to you for $9.95. You know? So we do these very funny things, and we all are doing it so much that we've forgotten about, that's not my lamp. It's like, I love this thing that, who's the great web, who's the guy?
Bill Gates?
Bill, let's say it's Bill Gates. You know, they were talking about this idea that we shouldn't have to pay taxes. You know, this whole issue around tax relief. And I think his case was like,
I know what you're talking about.
I don't mind paying for supporting the infrastructure that gave us this World Wide Web. I didn't invent electronics. I just used it to make a profit.
Right.
So it's like shippers didn't invent the highways or the trucks, but they used them to make a profit. So of course they need to pour some of their profit back into the support of the infrastructure. It's kind of like, duh. And it's like that for us. It's like, We didn't invent these things. We just have the privilege of sitting here by the light of this, this extraordinary formation that's thousands of moments of contribution by infinite numbers of creatures have contributed to there being light in this room. Mr. Edison and you name it, and the paper makers and the wire makers and the metal shapers and the, I mean, there's no end to what each thing, you know, I don't own it. How could I own this? How could I own anything?
A Native American woman came up to me and she said, you know, we just really don't get that you white people are thinking about that you can own stuff.
Like the land?
Or the air. Or even food.
Or the oil.
You know, and what an extraordinary trance we are being invited to engage in with ownership.
Well.
Own more. You know, that's a real trap in our culture.
It's powerful. It's not just our culture. It's global, cultural, and more people are, you know, becoming devotees of that understanding. It's like,
but that's where suffering is.
It's the basis for egoic behavior, and
to think actually that Anthony is something is such a puzzle.
It's a puzzle, and it's a puzzle that's been, you know, very many different ways have been tried to work with this puzzle. And, you know, we're still in the midst, in the throes of some terrible experiments for the human being.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of forces that are moving through our culture and world culture. And, you know, I feel very in awe of being alive and having some sense of what's beyond the horizons of my own village, because I do have this kind of global access through these kinds of electronic, you know, magnificent electronic gadgets. But the stuff that's coming through the airwaves is a little bit stunningly horrific. In great
it's
many cases,
strange.
I'm like, oh, no,
right.
No. Not another 10 people killed by a young boy. I mean, that's today's news.
And even, so, you know, the person themselves think of taking their own life, either in, you know, for whatever reason.
So I think in our way of trying to contribute, you know, having received the gift of life and wanting to give back, that I like the idea that we do live locally. We live here. We take care of this land. We share this land. It's not ours. I don't own it. I don't have a mortgage or a right to be here. I'm here by agreement, and anyone can be here by agreement
of the group.
So there's an open system. We agree on the regulations by which that system operates.
But and it's mindful.
It's mindful. It's it makes its best effort to take minimum amounts of resources and so on. And at the same time that I live locally in the best way I've been able to find to do that, by sharing and living in community, living in a shared world, in a very small space. I have a small house. Everyone has a small space. And then we've got all this outdoors to wander in. So this is kind of like an amazing, you know, gift to my life. But the corollary is that I need to always think globally, think about how it is for everyone else, and that how to extend the benefit to others. You know, how to bring whatever the benefit I've received, what's the way that we can extend past our own good fortune to benefit those who have not yet established themselves in good fortune? And that's, to me, that's, we don't get to rest. You don't get to stop here.
And how can, and I guess my point is how to bring awareness to the ignorant. And it's not to be in a condescending, oh, you're ignorant. You're so,
No.
It's
no,
more
no.
about, well, I have something that might really be of wonderful use for you if you would listen to this. And that's part of what I feel so privileged to be able to broadcast our conversation on the radio. You know, it's just a real, you know, so that there are many people who I would hope would listen to what we are speaking about and have some interest in coming to explore more about their own experience.
Yeah.
Because that's really what it's about.
Yeah, right.
That's what really the Buddha came down from the mountain about into those that would vex him.
Yeah, that's right.
And so then what did he do? He began the teaching. I seem to recall that there was an original teaching that was pretty esoteric, that no one could understand him.
The Avatamsaka Sutra.
Oh, really? Okay, so that he had to step it down a bit, and then he's had to step that down a bit, so that people who were quite ignorant could really begin to understand what his experience was and what he was offering to enlighten their ignorance.
Well, his first sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, is actually not, it's not that you can't read it, it's that, it's again like that story I was saying in the beginning where you go, hey, you, and the person says, yes, you immediately you can understand. If you read the Avatamsaka Sutra, there's nothing you don't understand. Mm-hmm. He's describing what he sees. He sees jewel trees mm-hmm. dripping with rainbow-colored precious gems and the ground covered with rainbow flowers and the sky with dragons and clouds that are all of different formations with rays shining. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going on and on and on, page after page after page, where I think it's over 1,000 pages.
Oh, my Lord.
Describing the vision, the enlightened vision. There's not one word in the text that one that a child of 12 can't read.
Right.
It's like for us to see that he's talking about this very world.
In this moment.
He's describing what he sees.
In this moment.
In this moment, you know. And if you look around, after the rain falls and there's all these little jewels hanging from every... Ugh. I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, he's talking about this place here. But yeah. It feels as though he's talking about some magical land over the rainbow, Wizard mm-hmm. of Oz kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So... when he gave this teaching originally, the humans said, how about my Aunt Sarah, whose gout is acting up? I mean, can't we talk about something real here?
Right.
So because we live in this world of mundane vision, then people wanted to hear a mundane explanation about their lives. So he basically agreed, and he entered by saying, well, there is suffering. There is suffering, and there's a cause of this suffering, and that cause is wanting things to be other than they are. So that was mm-hmm. the first and second noble truth.
Right.
This is samsara. This is how the world of suffering, and that's what he'd been studying the night of his enlightenment. It was how the mind tricks itself into interpreting what's happening as something I don't want, something I don't like. Basically, he said, when we stop doing that, when we reverse that desiring things to be other than they are, right there is peace, is nirvana.
Right there.
Third noble truth, cessation of suffering.
Oh, that's the blowout.
That's the four. Yeah, that's the first two noble truths are samsara. The second, third, and fourth are nirvana. What's the way? How do you do that? They said, how do you do that? You got our attention now. How do you end suffering? And he said, well, it's a way of life. You stop lying. You stop speaking ill of others. You be generous.
The Eightfold Path.
It's a way of life. You change your lifestyle.
You live rightly. You don't steal.
You don't kill. You don't intoxicate yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't accumulate great wealth for your family at the expense of others. Mm-hmm. You share what you have. You share your wisdom. You share your good fortune. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like things you already know. It's like human life lived with integrity, with compassion. It's every spiritual tradition holds these same values as primary. They're mm-hmm. obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, but you have to, and then somebody said, well, even a child of 12 can understand that. Yes, but an old man of 80 has a hard time living that way. So mm-hmm. everyone can understand this path, but who actually is willing to walk that path?